Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. Happy New Year, everyone. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, joined today by our super producer, Jason Ruggiero. Jason, how are you today?
I am pretty good. It's good to be here.
Did you have a good New Year's?
I did. We don't have cable.
Oh, yeah.
We are cord cutters, and so my wife, in her endless ingenuity, rigged up a contraption, if you will. It was our own personal ball drop.
Oh, nice.
It was much more exciting than the Times Square ball because we didn't know if it was going to work. It was Christmas lights rigged up through this baby Einstein ball, which then went over a nail and then was going to fall on one of my son's toys and set off a dazzling light show.
And how'd it go?
I had to dive on the toy after the ball failed to set off the dazzling light show. I had to do it manually.
That did add a whole new level of intrigue to your evening, I'm sure.
Yeah, but like I said, like, nothing exciting ever happens with that Times Square ball.
No.
You know, like, it's been falling correctly for, like, you know, the last however many years. This was exciting.
Yeah, and let's be honest, it was probably better than watching Carson Daly.
Yeah, I didn't have to listen to any of that.
None of that nonsense.
So that was a definite positive.
Well, I'm glad you had a great New Year's, Jason, but we have a lot of stuff to get to. It's been a fairly busy offseason for our Cleveland Indians and Pittsburgh Pirates, so we'll be talking a little bit about the Pirates, and then we'll transition to the Indians. But before we do that, I want to talk about A.J. Preller, the new general manager of the San Diego Padres, who has had a very busy offseason, trading for Matt Kemp, Justin Upton, and Will Myers, as well as Will Middlebrooks, and then just recently, within the past few days, traded their outfielder Seth Smith to the Mariners for their relief pitcher Brandon Maurer. So all in all, you could say it's been a busy offseason for the Padres. Jason, how do you feel about the San Diego Padres after this flurry of moves?
I think that they are still probably third fiddle in that division.
Really?
I don't think they're better than the Dodgers. And I don't think they're better than the Giants. And they seem to have cornered the market on right-handed outfield bats, but Will Myers playing center field
sounds
that'll be fun to watch.
Well, and that was one of the things that I wanted to bring up too, because it was interesting for a team that has such a pitcher-friendly park.
Yeah.
You know, you rely a lot on your outfield defense, you know, to kind of...
Their outfield defense is going to be awful.
And it just, it turned into an outfield that has three below-average defenders in the outfield, no matter where you play them. And then, then you're taking Will Myers, who is below-average in right field, and putting him in center field, presumably. It does...
Probably the only guy who you had that was capable of center field was Seth Smith, right?
And now you've shipped him to Seattle. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they still have they have Cameron Maybin and Will Venable who are...
That's true. Cameron Maybin could play center field.
They're good defenders, but you know, playing in the National League, you don't have the benefit of hiding a poor defender like Matt Kemp somewhere.
Right. Matt Kemp, he just, like, isn't interested in playing defense. That's his problem.
Yeah.
Like I don't know, Justin Upton just kind of strikes me as, you know, his body type and whatnot kind of prevents him from being an elite, you know, corner outfielder. But, I mean, Matt Kemp, he could be. He just doesn't feel like it.
Yeah. That's not what they pay him for.
He has no interest in that. Speaking of what they pay him for, were you trying to stifle laughter after the Matt Kemp trade when, like, the national beat writers were like, oh, it's such a steal for the Padres, oh, such an amazing trade. It's like, well, then why the Dodgers want to get rid of him so bad?
Right. I mean, and they're still footing the bill for, I believe it's $15 million a year for Kemp. For the duration of his deal. So it's not like they're not getting him on the cheap, certainly. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the Padres are going to be better, obviously. I mean,
they'll be better.
You look at their team last year and they were dead last in runs, batting average, on base percentage, slugging percentage, like pick an offensive category and they were probably dead last in it.
But okay, like take first of all, Will Myers. We don't really know what Will Myers is, you know?
And the Rays seemed awful happy to get rid of him.
They sure did. And I know Andrew Friedman's not there anymore, but that still is questionable, you know, when, was it 2 years? Or was one, 2 years?
2 years, yeah.
2 years after, you know, he's your big piece. You're like, okay, we've seen enough of you.
Right.
Will Middlebrooks, he couldn't hit 20 home runs in Fenway. What kind of hitter is he going to be in Petco?
That's a very good question. I mean, he's probably going to be a better option at third base, or I guess you would assume that he'd probably be a better option at third base than Jervis Solarte, but...
Right, but I'm just saying, like, let's not, you know, fall back into the Will Middlebrooks' hype machine.
Right.
So let's see, they have, what, Kemp, Myers, Upton, right? And then Middlebrooks.
And Alonzo at the corners.
And Alonzo, and then Everett Cabrera?
No, Cabrera was non-tendered, so that I think they signed Clint Barmas, but he's not their starting shortstop. They have a guy ahead of him, Amarista, maybe. Alexi Amarista. And then Giorgio at second. And then they traded for Derek Norris. So they have Derek Norris behind the plate.
Because they traded Grandal, right?
Yeah, Grandal went to the Dodgers. So
that'll be good for the Dodgers.
Which, yeah, I mean, the Dodgers are a better... I know we're talking about the Padres, but the Dodgers, I think, are a better team without Kemp because they get to put Jock Peterson in their lineup now.
And they replace AJ Ells with Yasmani Grandal.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, overall, again, I feel like...
$15 million off the books.
I feel like the Padres are in a position that the Pirates were in a few years ago, where, like, they just needed to go out and sign some players so they can be like, look, we're a destination. And, you know, now they have some players. They have a little bit of credibility. They have, you know, guys who have had some MVP votes and things like that. I don't know. I think it was good moves for them. I agree with you that it doesn't put them anywhere near the top of that division. Or I guess I would be surprised if it did.
Let's look at it this way. From a fantasy baseball perspective. So, when you're towards the end of your draft, right, and you just, like, need that, you know, last pitcher on your bench that you're gonna stream through or whatever... If it's between person A and person B, and they're pretty much the same, person A is on the Padres, that's probably in his favor, right? Because you're like, oh, that's a pitcher's park, you know?
Right.
But is that still a good thing now? Because now it's a pitcher pitching in a giant outfield with three really bad outfielders.
I can tell you I own Tyson Ross in a Dynasty League, and it doesn't make me feel great about it.
Perfect.
So I think they'll be a team to watch. I think it gets them some of the attention that a team needs in order to kind of start.
Here's what I think. I think they'll be a big story in April, and by June they'll be a disaster.
Interesting. I got to give you credit. You're pretty good at. We're gonna have to get our board back out to write some of these things down. But you're and I needed to bring this up also. So before we get talking about the Pirates. Chris Davis, do you remember your prediction on Chris Davis?
I do. I wasn't that far off, though.
I think, no, you nailed it. He didn't get any MVP votes. That was your call. We said I went back and listened to the podcast. Our deal was, if would you consider Chris Davis a bust this season if he doesn't get any MVP votes? And your response was, yes, that was what you thought would constitute a bust.
There so, you go.
I gotta give you some props on that one, Jason. You called that one.
Well, thank you.
So I'll jot this one down on our dry erase board so we got it.
Okay.
That you're calling it. By June the Padres are a disaster.
That's a quote.
Got it. Okay, well let's talk about some teams that matter now, Jason. We gotta get down to business today. So we're gonna kick things off talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates first. So I wanted to start off with the Pirates by talking about how they've looked to kind of revamp their starting rotation. The starting rotation will actually look very similar to the starting rotation two years ago. Because they brought back AJ Burnett and they re-signed Francisco Liriano, which I think were two fantastic moves. And they're two moves that a club like the Pirates, again, they have to make because they don't have the guys. You know, they aren't going out and signing Max Scherzer, and they don't have the guys to plug in right away. You know, like you're not going into next season plugging Nick Kingham in your rotation right away. So the Pirates went out and got AJ Burnett, who they got him at a discount. Burnett has said in multiple interviews he was just happy to go back to Pittsburgh and he didn't really care about the contract, and he opted out of a $12.75 million player option in Philadelphia to come back to Pittsburgh for 1 year and $8.5 million. So,
wow. Philadelphia.
Philadelphia was a train wreck, that is true. But, you know, he could have made $4 million more staying there. And
he could've.
I think there's something to be said about, and I mentioned this in the article I wrote the other day, I think there's something to be said about the culture that Pittsburgh has kind of built there. You know, I know we've talked about it before, just all the time about how the fans are in Pittsburgh. They haven't gone anywhere. I mean, they didn't show up to the stadium after 20 years of losing, but you know, it didn't take much to bring them back to the ballpark, just the competitive ball team. And I think AJ Burnett after, especially, you know, AJ Burnett is not the most level-headed person. You know, he's a very passionate and fiery personality, it seems, and after pitching in New York and having fans boo him and just, you know, the media just hounding him constantly, he came to Pittsburgh and, you know, we would give him standing ovations for throwing five innings and giving up three earned runs. So, you know, and when he came back at his first start, he came back to PNC Park with the Phillies last season, he got a standing ovation and a video montage before his start. I mean, I really think that went a long way to showing how much he was appreciated, and I think that went a long way to helping bring him back to Pittsburgh.
No, I think you're right. What do you think old AJ has left in the tank?
He has nothing suggests that he can't throw 200 innings. You know, that's basically been AJ Burnett is an innings eater as long as he's healthy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, like even last year with a herniated disc, I'll have to double check this to make sure I'm correct, but I think he threw 200 innings last year, even with that hernia. So, you know, AJ Burnett's coming back now. He's going to be coming back and he's going to be healthy. He had that hernia operated on this off season. And, if AJ Burnett can throw 200 innings and has an ERA under four, I'd say like 3.6 or better. I think Pittsburgh has got the value that they need out of AJ Burnett.
Okay.
Last season, by the way, he threw 213 innings. So
you think he can still keep the ERA under four?
Ideally, I mean, you look at his last two seasons in Pittsburgh at ages 35, 36, you know, an ERA of 3.5 in 2012, an ERA of 3.3 in 2013. His fastball velocity only went down a tick last season, I believe, because of that hernia. You know, Pittsburgh is a team that plays well for AJ Burnett. You know, he's a ground ball heavy pitcher. You know, they have a great defense behind him. Even if he doesn't like the shifts and even if he doesn't believe they work, you know, statistics clearly show that they do. And I think that will help play to his benefit as well. So I feel really great about that signing for 1 year, $8.5 million. And I think that's the kind of signing that Pittsburgh needed to make. So, but looking at Francisco Liriano, the Liriano contract, I described it as a great deal and a risky deal all wrapped up into one. You know what I mean?
Yep, I hear you.
3 years and $39 million is probably under market value for Francisco Liriano. You know, if he would have gone to the Giants, you know, the Giants were rumored to be pursuing him pretty heavily. You know, if he had gone to San Francisco, I wouldn't have been surprised to see 3 years and $45 million, you know.
Right.
He's coming to Pittsburgh for $11 million the first season, $13 million, and $13 million the last two seasons. I don't know how you feel as an Indians fan looking at that, but I mean, do you think that's a little under market for the season Liriano's had the last 2 years?
I do think that the yearly amounts are lower than he probably could have got, you know, if he opened it up fully to the market. Obviously, what makes you a little uncomfortable is the years because of his injury history, which I'm sure you're going to talk about.
Exactly. Well, and just like AJ Burnett is the consummate innings eater, Francisco Liriano is the antithesis of that. He's never thrown 200 innings in his career.
Yeah, I read that in your article, and I was like, wow, I never kind of thought, you know, I never looked into it. But when you wrote that, I was like, well, I can believe it. Like, I don't doubt that one bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of wild when you look at it. You know, obviously his last 2 years in Pittsburgh were exceptional. 3.02 ERA in 2013 and then 3.38 ERA last season.
Now, he missed time last season.
He's missed times both of the last, you know, both of his seasons in Pittsburgh, obviously with the broken arm, and then last season he missed time as well.
Right. The first one, it was the arm, which wasn't really related. But last year, it was actually a baseball injury.
Yeah, and I can pull it up here while we're taking a look at that. But, yeah, I mean, last season he only threw... last season he threw 162 innings, 162 and a third innings.
I mean, that's got to be like the ceiling, right, of what you can truly count on him for.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think when you're factoring in, yeah. I mean, there's certainly nothing to suggest that he's going to go out this season and throw 213 innings. You know.
Right. Like, right.
Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah. Last season he missed time with an oblique strain. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's a good signing in that you look at Francisco Liriano's peripherals. You know, he's striking out, you know, last season he was almost striking out 10 batters per nine. You know, his walk rate was a little bit higher last season, you know, a little bit higher whip. He seemed a little more erratic at times, and that kind of reflected in his more advanced numbers as well. But... yeah, I mean, you can't... 162 innings, 175 strikeouts, that's some amazing production.
All right, he's a strikeout machine. I mean, he always has been. It's all about, like you said, it's all about the health with him.
Right. The health and the consistency. I mean, there's no questioning his stuff. You know, he throws a 94-mile-an-hour sinker, a nasty, just wipeout slider, a changeup that just dies... And, you know, that's all on top of his four-seam fastball that sits around 94.
When he's healthy, he's nasty.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it is just we are all just praying to Ray Searidge this offseason. Keep that right, Ray. Just that's...
Well, I think the I agree with you. You definitely, you know, sacrificing to the Ray Searidge altar, but part of, I think, what makes it a little more concerning, like, if it was someone who just was kind of a mechanical mess, or that Searidge had taught a new pitch or new approach to, you'd be pretty comfortable that the wizardry would continue, but the health is something, you know, Ray Searidge, he can't really control that, so that's what makes it kind of nerve-wracking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a very Logical point. Yeah, I mean, if you're, you know, if you have a strained oblique or a sore shoulder or whatever, all the pitching and coaching in the world isn't going to help you.
Right. But so, I mean, I guess, you know, let's say we always talk about you're paying a little bit less in annual average value, but you're paying a little, you're taking on a little more risk in the years, pretty much hoping that at least probably, you know, two of those years he's pitching 160 innings. You know what I, you understand what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
You're kind of hoping for like, well, we got him for 3 years. We know he has injury trouble. Hopefully at least two of those years he's there two-thirds of the time. I think if he did that, you would consider that a win at the end, right?
I would absolutely. Yeah, and that's what we've been talking about all basically all winter long, is you're hoping for two out of three great seasons. That's like, yeah. in just a crazy world, you know, if you were just imagining like if you just had to cut one of those seasons out, like if his arm just exploded or whatever and he was gone for a season, you would hope that two out of those three seasons were great.
Right.
And, you know, baseball doesn't work out like that. You know, it's probably going to end up being part of the seasons he'll be healthy and part of the seasons he won't be. Yeah. And it'll kind of all come out in the wash at the end. But, yeah, you're hoping for basically like two really healthy seasons.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a weird thing to have to hope for, but.
So Edison Volquez has left now. He signed with the Royals.
Yeah, the Royals, who must be out of their minds.
Let's not get off on that subject. Yeah. So you got Garrett Cole,
so
Liriano.
The Pirates' rotation right now is probably going to look like, I would assume Liriano is going to be up at the top, since he's the, you know, the highest paid. You know, pitcher on their staff. So I would assume it would probably go Liriano, Cole, Burnett, and then down at the bottom, you have, you know, your guys kind of rotating in Jeff Locke, Vance Worley, you know, Brandon Compton, those guys kind of cycling in, just trying to kind of play the hot hand down at the bottom of that rotation. I firmly believe at some point, I think next season, at some point, Nick Kingham is going to be up. You know, just after having a chance to get some eyes on him when he was pitching with Altoona. You know, Nick Kingham last year was throwing fastballs on the stadium gun that were sitting around 96, a pretty heavy curveball that looked really good, getting a lot of guys to drive the ball into the ground. So I think at some point, and, you know, and obviously he got called up to AAA at the end of the season, so he was pitching for Indy at the end of the season there. I think at some point Nick Kingham will be up and they'll, you know, kind of get to see what he has. So, I think, yeah, you have your top three spots all set. You know, at some point, Charlie Morton will be healthy again, and you'll slot Charlie Morton in there.
All right.
That's kind of what we're looking at. I feel pretty good about the rotation now that we have Liriano and Burnett back for next season.
Yeah.
To kind of couple with the pitchers, though, since we spend a lot of time talking about the pitching, the Pirates traded for the New York Yankees catcher Francisco Cervelli, which I believe we talked about on the last podcast. Did that happen when we recorded last?
I'm pretty sure we talked about that.
I think it did. But the more and more I look at this trade, the more and more I really start to like it.
Okay.
One of the things that I've been reading up a lot on lately, and in the article I wrote the other day, you can I linked to the article when I was talking about Cervelli, but Ben Lindbergh of Grantland wrote about the art of pitch framing. And how basically pitch framing was one of those market inefficiencies that for a long time teams really either didn't place a value on or didn't understand how to quantify the value of pitch framing. And it was a phenomenal article about how valuable a good pitch framer can be. And actually Baseball Prospectus tracks the catcher's ability to manipulate the strike zone with a statistic that they created. And I linked to a pretty neat article about that as well. So it's definitely worth going to check out our article about the Pirates offseason at our website if you get a chance. There's some pretty awesome articles that we link to there. But from everything that you read about Cervelli, you know, obviously you can look at his offensive numbers and they are not impressive at all. But he is regarded as one of the best receiving catchers in baseball. And if you go look at the statistics that are out there on pitch framing and what statistics can measure about pitch framing now, they put him right up at the top as one of the best pitch framers in baseball, which is a pretty impressive thing. And that was what, I don't know if people really remember, but when the Pirates went out and signed Russell Martin, it wasn't received positively. You know, it wasn't viewed as like a great steal, which is what it ended up turning out to be at 2 years and $17 million. I think even my initial reaction was that $8.5 million we overpaid. You know, like, I didn't think it was a horrible move, but I certainly didn't think it was going to end up being as great as it was.
Right.
And I think a lot of that, too, is because Pittsburgh had already kind of started to figure out one of the market inefficiencies that they could take advantage of was pitch framing. And that was one of the things that Russell Martin excelled at as well.
So you think Cervelli is equal or better than Martin as a pitch framer?
Statistically speaking, that's what the numbers would suggest. Now, obviously, offensively, you can't look at Francisco Cervelli and expect him to go out and hit 290 with a 402 on base percentage and a 430 slugging next season.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, if he can go out there and hit 240, and, you know, he's... Because I think the thing that nobody can really understand and the thing that baseball has yet to figure out how to quantify is really just how much does pitch framing help your pitchers. You know, like, they can show you how many strikes you can steal, basically. But, you know, you don't understand how that affects a pitcher's ability to perform. So that's the thing I'm kind of worried about is, you know, you go from having a really stable, consistent guy behind the plate like Russell Martin to... You know, suddenly you have a question mark there. How does that affect your pitchers?
Right.
So the more and more I look at this deal with Francisco Cervelli, the more and more I like it. Cervelli's only going to cost, you know, maybe $1 million next season. So I feel really good about that.
All right. Well, you can feel really good about it for about 7 more weeks, and then we'll see what happens.
We're going to start seeing how that plays out. One of the other moves that the Pirates made, which was an internal move, was sliding Pedro Alvarez from third base over to first base.
Yeah.
The future is now.
Pedro.
Yeah.
They didn't just move him to first. They got him a buddy.
They did. Well, they moved him to first, and then they traded away all of his platoon mates. Which seemed like a very alarming thing to do. And then, after moving Pedro to first, they signed Corey Hart, former Milwaukee Brewer and Pirate Slayer Corey Hart, to a one-year, $2.5 million deal that could potentially end up working out to be a $5 million deal with all the incentives. I don't know if you saw the numbers that Corey Hart put up against Pittsburgh in his career.
No, I just know that everyone's referred to him as a Pirate Slayer.
He just murders the Pirates. He has 376 plate appearances against the Pirates. So basically like half a season worth of plate appearances against the Pirates. He hit 303, 352, 554 against the Pirates.
Oh my goodness.
And 896 OPS. 15 home runs. Just, yeah, murdered the Pirates.
Wow.
So, but the Pirates got Hart assuming, or I guess we're all assuming the Pirates signed Corey Hart to be the short side of Pedro Alvarez's platoon at first base. So, you know, Corey Hart has a lot of pop in his bat. You know, he's 32 years old, so it's not like he's that much older than Gabby Sanchez would have been. And I think he has a little more upside than Gabby Sanchez, obviously. So, I like that signing. I think it's great to kind of, even if something were to happen to Pedro, you know, you could have Hart out there at, you know, at full time because he's on the, you know, the right side of the platoon, I guess, for that to happen, so.
Right.
So, yeah, right. I feel pretty good about signing of Corey Hart. You know, it wasn't a ridiculous contract. It was a good deal for a guy to kind of rebuild his value. You got a one-year deal, and yeah, I think you have a lot of upside with that, obviously, and so does Corey Hart with, you know, the $2.5 million worth of incentives that he has. So
what about Jung Ho Kong?
Yeah, Kong is, this is the only move that I think was kind of out of character for the Pirates. I don't know how you felt when you saw it, but it didn't really feel like a Pittsburgh Pirates move.
Yeah, it took me by surprise. I kind of feel like... Well, I kind of feel like they, when they look around the infield, you know, they're like, well, we don't know how we feel about Josh Harrison. We don't know what Josh Harrison we're going to get. Jordy Mercer is, maybe he's average. And Neil Walker is good when his back's okay.
Right.
Now, they signed, you know, Sean Rodriguez and Pedro Florimon as depth for the infield. But I think they kind of looked around and they thought, you know, if we could get this guy cheap, we can make room for another infielder.
Yeah.
And maybe he'll be better than at least Jordy Mercer, if not the bad Josh Harrison or the hurt Neil Walker.
Right. The thing to me that seemed out of character, I guess, was that they signed Kong. So Pittsburgh had to post $5 million.
Right.
And then he's seeking, apparently, a four-year deal worth $20 million. So you're looking at, you know, basically $5 million a year, plus the $5 million on top of that. So you're looking at $6 million a year for Kong when it all comes out in the end. And so Pittsburgh signing him basically is infield depth right now. So,
well, yes, but I don't think they really see it that way. I think what they see is... like if you look back to when Ichiro came over, you know, no one really knew what was going on, how good Ichiro was going to be. I think he signed for like either $14 or $20 million for like 3 years. And of course, he turned out to be amazing.
Right.
And I think it's kind of like right now we're at this point where... when a Cuban player comes out, we assume he's going to be amazing. Because, you know, the last couple have been amazing. Jose Abreu and Yasiel Puig. And so we assume Yasmani Tomas and... the guy the Red Sox got.
Rezny Casillo.
Yeah, are just going to be, you know... thunderbolts sent down from above.
Right.
And then here's this guy who hit like 40 home runs in the Korean League, and everybody's just like, meh, I'm not really interested.
Right.
And so I think the Pirates are like looking around and they're like, hey, you know what? Like, this guy might actually be good. Like, nobody might realize it because he's Korean and nobody's really sure how these Korean stats are going to translate. And I mean, what I've read, I don't know, maybe you've heard other things, like Kylie McDaniel at Fangraphs was saying, you know, he obviously doesn't expect him to hit 40 home runs, but he wouldn't be surprised by 15, and he wouldn't be surprised by 20. And he's saying, you know, if you've got a 15 or 20 home run shortstop for $5 or $6 million, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And even if he's a third baseman, maybe he can't stick it short, you know, that's a pretty legitimate player. You know, like he was saying, like, if you think you're going to bat, this was before the Pirates won the postings, so he's talking kind of in generalities, but he's like, if you think, you know, Kong's going to come to your team and bat fourth or fifth, you're going to be disappointed. But if you think Kong's going to come to your team and bat sixth or seventh, you're probably going to be really happy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, I think he could add some serious depth to the Pirates.
Well, here's how I looked at it. So if you, and I wrote about this in the article as well, but you figure the average price of a win, so, you know, when we're talking about the worst stat, the average price of a win on the free agent market is somewhere between $6 and $7 million.
Right.
Kong basically just has to turn in the offensive production of Brad Miller last season in order for the Pirates to really... make out in this deal. In order for the Pirates to come away and get the statistical value that they need for the money that they're paying for Kong, they need him to go out and just, you know, be an average offensive player and not hurt them too badly on defense. That's really all they need. I mean, Brad Miller last season hit 10 home runs, hit .221 with a .288 on base percentage and a .365 slugging.
Right, and when you look at it like that, I think if you gave me those numbers and told me to take the over or the under for Kong, I'd take the over easy.
I mean, his power is ridiculous. I've been watching videos of him anywhere I can find them. And he has some of the best bat flips that you'll see. Just straight up, just disrespectful bat flips. I love it. But yeah, I mean, just like light tower power. So a lot of it will just be, you know, the same thing that every player has to do coming from wherever they're coming from. Just how do your skills translate to the majors?
Yeah. I mean, that's what Connor McDaniel said. He punishes fastballs, and you can get him crossed up changing speeds on him.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty much every power hitter. So,
right.
You know, it's about how what kind of approach do you take up there, and how often do you make the person pay when you get your pitch, you know?
Exactly.
If you make them pay enough, everybody will forget about the strikeouts. So it'll be interesting. There was a joke they were kind of joking around. I think it's on the Fangraphs podcast, but Dave Cameron's been on vacation, so I think it was Carson Cestulli and Jeff Sullivan. And Jeff Sullivan, I think, said, he's like, you know, I kind of feel like maybe the Pirates front office put the bid in for Kong and then, like, went out to lunch. and they just kind of like, yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, we might as well. And then they, like, got the call. They're like, oh, shit.
Like,
we won?
You mean we won this? Yeah.
That was all it took, $5 million.
It was like eBay bidding gone bad.
Yeah, like, they're just, like, sitting there at, you know, Primanti Brothers or something. Neil Huntington's phone goes off, and he's like, huh?
That was all it took.
All right. I figured, you know, somebody else had bid, like, $10, $20 million.
That's funny.
But so they still have to sign him, though, right?
Right, yeah. So they're working. They have a 30-day window to negotiate a deal with him. And then if they can't reach an agreement, the $5 million posting fee goes back to the Pirates and Kong has to go back for another year.
Everyone returns to their original locations.
Yep, that's it. So, yeah, but that's pretty much all I wanted to hit on with the Pirates. They've had, you know, like I said, it's been an interesting offseason. Not as busy as the Padres, but, you know, they've been shaking things up a little bit.
Yeah.
So, that's pretty much all I want to hit on. So, what's going on with the Cleveland Indians, Jason? What do you want to talk about with the Tribe?
Well, it's been pretty slow with the Cleveland Indians. They had their finally on the first day of the winter meetings. They pulled off the worst kept secret in baseball, trading Joey Wendell for Brandon Moss. I'm going to talk about that for a little bit, and then they have signed some minor league depth arms and bats, guys like Jerry Sands and the like.
Right.
You know, and I really, like, some people get all worked up about those. I really could care less about them. You know, every team does that. You might as well fill out that roster and see if somebody sticks.
That's what we call organizational depth.
Yeah. There's nobody too exciting. Although I did see on MLB Trade Rumors today that they signed Casey Weathers, which is a name that sounded familiar to me, although I couldn't tell you why, to a minor league, you know, invitation to spring training or whatever.
Yeah.
And I guess he's been hurt, you know, last couple of years, like most of those guys are. But he was recently clocked throwing 106.
Wow.
So that got my attention. So I have no idea, but that'll be interesting just to see if he can ever replicate that.
Yeah.
But anyways, the other big move was that they signed Gavin Floyd. And they didn't just sign Gavin Floyd. I think it was a $4 million contract. They didn't just sign Gavin Floyd. During the press conference, the Indians GM, Chris Antonetti, came out and said that Gavin Floyd has a spot in the rotation. Boom. Done. Sealed and delivered. This sent out, like, a little bit of a shockwave because it was kind of like, okay, so Kluber, Floyd, and then I think there was a little bit of option confusion. So I think people were, I think Bauer's out of options, though the Indians can, like, ask for one more, which I think they're pursuing. But so say it's Kluber, Floyd, Bauer. Okay, well, that leaves McAllister, who's out of options, Tomlin, who has options, Salazar, and House. House has options, and everyone thought Salazar was out of options. Then the Indians released a corresponding press release that they had been granted an extra option for Danny Salazar.
Okay.
And then the Twitter sphere fell back to earth.
Everything was as it should have been.
Yeah.
So the Indians' rotation now, so once they guarantee Gavin Floyd that spot in the rotation, you have Kluber up at the top, Carlos Carrasco number two?
Oh, that was, yes, Carrasco, yeah.
And then is Bauer number three after that?
Well, I mean, I think you have to put Floyd three because he's guaranteed.
Okay.
The thing with both Bauer and Salazar is, not to get into the minutia of it, but if you spend under a certain number of days on the active roster for the major league team, the team, and it's in three consecutive seasons, I think if you spend less than 90 days, three consecutive seasons, the team can ask for a fourth option.
Okay.
And some of it has to do with injury time and all this kind of thing. And so for Salazar, they got the fourth option. And there was some confusion whether or not they could pursue one for Bauer. But for right now, I think it's Kluber, Carrasco, Floyd, and Bauer. And then Tomlin's probably going to AAA because he has options. I would assume the same with House, and that the final spot is really between Salazar and McAllister. And there's been some competing, like, theories. Some people are kind of saying, like, well, they'll probably give McAllister the old Carlos Carrasco treatment, like last year when Carrasco was out of options.
Right.
He'll probably pitch okay, and they'll say, like, well, we want to give Zach every opportunity, blah, 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 and they'll put him in the rotation, and if he doesn't work out after a month or two, you know, they'll put him in the bullpen, which is certainly a possibility, because that would keep them totally covered with three guys stretched out in AAA.
Yeah.
Because if you put McAllister in the bullpen right away and say Salazar, then you're just left with House and Tomlin, which is still good, but obviously a little bit less depth. But not to dwell on that, I'd rather talk about Gavin Floyd a little bit more. Because he's kind of an interesting guy to bring in for $4 million. Trying to find the stat here. He missed time two seasons ago. Well, it was, did he have Tommy John?
Yeah, Gavin Floyd has had Tommy John.
Yeah, two seasons ago he had Tommy John. And last season, though, he missed time, and it was due to some goofy injury. It was an elbow problem, but it was not like a pitching elbow problem kind of deal.
Yeah.
He's kind of in that, you know, he's not near the pitcher of Francisco Liriano, but he has that injury concern profile.
He definitely has the injury concern of Francisco Liriano.
Like, Steamer only projects him for 105 innings.
Right.
But over those 105 innings, you know, he has a, let me find it, a 7. His career K rate is 7. His career walk rate is 3. They project him for a 4.26 ERA, which isn't, you know, great. But last year, when he was healthy with the Braves, he only pitched 54 innings, and he had like a 2-something ERA. So he's an intriguing guy to have around, you know.
And you guys do have, I will say, you have Mickey Callaway there, who the Mickey Callaway magic,
right,
does do some pretty spectacular things in Cleveland.
Right. So that'll be interesting. I'm trying to scan this article to remember what a fractured bone in his pitching elbow. is what cut last season off. So it's not like a relapse of the Tommy John.
Right.
You know, it was some kind of freak fracture. So I think, you know, with the depth in place of Tomlin, McAllister, House, Salazar, plus the other guys they've kind of gathered up during the offseason, I think it's a good move for them because it has the payoff of a lot more than $4 million, but it's only a $4 million investment.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, even with only being projected for 100 innings, he projects out to 0.8 WAR. So, you know, he's a solid pitcher. If he's there, great. If he's not, we'll move on without him.
Right.
The other guy, though, I want to spend a little time on is Brandon Moss, who I think is probably the Indians' big acquisition, much to the chagrin of many Indians fans. And one of the problems, you know, is they look around and they're like, we don't need another left-handed hitter. Why do they keep bringing in left-handed hitters?
Right.
And, I mean, other than the silliness of the fact that Chris Antonetti's never going to say, we need a right-handed hitter because then it's going to cut its market way down. When you actually look at the numbers, Progressive Field is much better power-wise for left-handed hitters than right-handed hitters. And as Antonetti loves to point out, because he's made a career, let's not forget, out of left-handed heavy lineups. Remember a couple years ago when there were times their entire lineup was left-handed?
It was just straight lefties.
And as he would always say then and is still saying now, don't forget, 70% of the pitching is right-handed. That's a quote. And this is a quote from Antonetti also, talking about Brandon Moss. We think he fits our ballpark well, and his power plays to our ballpark. And that's not just, like, something you say. I mean, that's something that's part of the reason they brought him in. Let me find the exact stat here. Okay. Of course, we got to remember that Moss played in Oakland Coliseum, which is one of the worst power-hitting ballparks.
Right.
And he's quoted in this article as well, saying, I'll be honest, other than it being our home stadium and I love the fans, I hated playing in the Coliseum. It killed me as a hitter. I pretty much made my seasons on the road. All right, so that's good to know. So over his career at home being Oakland, he had a 776 OPS, while on the road, he had a 904 OPS. So that's a big split, obviously.
Yeah, those are some crazy splits.
He had a 544 slugging percentage on the road for the past 3 years. That was actually fourth in the majors, behind David Ortiz, Mike Trout, and Miguel Cabrera. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Those splits are crazy.
Yeah. Over that time, that over 900 road OPS ranks seventh among that same group, guys with 500 more plate appearances.
Yeah.
And it's all big-time players like Trout, Ortiz, Posey, Goldschmidt, Kutch, and Edwin Encarnacion. So, a good little barometer here is that over the past, how many seasons? 10 seasons, lefties at Progressive Field have slugged 420 and had a 759 OPS, and in Oakland they've slugged 385 with a 709 OPS. So Fangraphs has lefty hitters experiencing a 9% boost in home runs in Cleveland as opposed to a neutral park.
Okay.
So basically what this all boils down to is when guys like August Fagerstrom and the fella at Let's Go Tribe predict Brandon Moss for 30 home runs, maybe that's not so crazy.
Yeah.
Because he's hitting, you know, mid to low 20s in Oakland, and he's saying, and the numbers are saying, that it was really sapping his power. You know, obviously, this isn't factoring in any kind of age or injury regression from this tip. You know, hopefully even with that, it's going to show a slight bump. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe 28 home runs, and in a good year, it'd be 30 or 31. That's going to look pretty nice in the Indians lineup, that's for sure. A lot better than Joey Wendell was going to look, blocked five prospects deep.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really kind of unsung trade, and hopefully one that I'm still happy about in June.
Now, how long is Moss under contract for? Is he a 1 year?
He is... No, I think he's two.
You got 2 years of Moss?
I'm pretty sure. I'll check right now. If I can get my...
I mean, it's a great trade, I think, for both sides when you're talking about Oakland needing to... or feeling the need to revamp their whole entire lineup. You know, they go get a guy, Joey Wendell, who Wendell could feasibly be competing for a spot in their lineup this season.
Right. Oh, yeah. I think... especially in a place like Oakland where you're competing with Eric Sogard.
Right.
Wendell's probably, you know, Eric Sogard level plus with the bat. I don't know if he's Sogard level with the glove yet, but it wouldn't be that big of a drop-off for sure.
Yeah, so this season, Moss is... this is his second year of arbitration.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So, yeah, so, you'll have him this season and next season.
Yeah, he's a two-year player, And I think it's an interesting trade. I mean, yeah, he's left-handed. It would be a lot better if you weren't trying to partner him with, like, Ryan Rayburn, you know, as part of the platoon. Or it was the Ryan Rayburn of 2 years ago. But don't forget, there's some outfield prospects coming, you know, guys like Tyler Naquin, James Ramsey, and... If Ryan Rayburn, you know, I know they signed him to that extension, but he's only really making like $4 million. If he's awful, they'll just DFA him and probably use Tyler Holt, because Tyler Holt is not the hitter that the good Ryan Rayburn can be, but he's like 10 times the outfielder. And even that would be maybe a better platoon mate for Brandon Moss, because you could just start Moss every day, and let Holt come in as a defensive replacement and cover Moss at the end of the game when his defensive liabilities show up more.
That's interesting. So I'm assuming Moss is going to be splitting time in right field, DH.
Yeah.
However, Cleveland, because Cleveland has that whole glut of players, like you have Carlos Santana and Nick Swisher and David Murphy, and you're trying to, like, cycle all of these guys into, like...
Well, yeah. I think David Murphy's probably going to get traded. I think the Indians were probably a little PO'd that the Padres loaded up on outfielders and wanted to trade Seth Smith to the Mariners, because I think that was their tact. But I think David Murphy's not the outfielder Seth Smith is, obviously. So I think David Murphy's probably going to get unloaded. They'll probably go into the season with Rayburn just because he is the complimentary platoon mate. Like I said, he'll probably have a pretty short leash. And then they'll have this, like, Moss, Swisher, Rayburn thing going on in right field, and this Moss, Swisher, Santana thing going on at first, and this Moss, Swisher, Santana thing going on at DH.
And just cycle all the guys through.
Yeah, I think what you're really going to see, though, of those is Moss is going to probably be the right fielder most of the time, and Santana's probably going to be the first baseman exclusively, unless he's DHing. And Swisher's probably going to see most of his time at DH, because you try to want to save those bionic knees as much as possible, I imagine.
Yeah.
The thing is, if Swisher could play the outfield, he'd be like the perfect platoon mate for Moss. Because he could cover the other side of the platoon. But...
We know his opinions on that.
I just don't believe Swisher can still play the outfield.
And he said as much. He said, you know, I'm not an outfielder. That's part of the reason why he believed he had those shoulder problems.
I know, and that's why I'm skeptical every time people are like, oh, they point to some quote about Swisher playing in the outfield. It's like, no, 2 years ago, they were pinning all his shoulder problems on the outfield. Now right. They're going to put him back out there? I don't see that happening. They need everything they can get out of that $15 million man, and the best place for them to get it is DH.
Right, exactly. Extract all the value you can out of there.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to bring up with you, because I'm just kind of curious on your opinion about this, but Asdrubal Cabrera is apparently he is agreed to a 1-year deal with the Rays. I think it was finalized. How do you feel about that, signing with the Rays?
I think that, first of all, when I saw that he got $8 million?
Yeah, yes, I believe.
When I saw that, I thought, man, I'm really glad they traded him because they would have, there was a lot of talk about, you know, like, well, what are they going to do if they keep him? Like, would you give him the qualifying offer? Wouldn't you? And it was like, obviously, like, if he only got a 1 year and $8 million, obviously their concerns about giving him a qualifying offer were correct.
Right.
And they would have been right to not give him one, which means he would have left for nothing. And instead, we get James Ramsey, who's a AAA outfielder. I mean, you know, he's a lot better than nothing, no matter what happens.
Yeah.
When I saw him going to the Rays, the first thing I imagined, well, the first thing I actually thought was, oh, poor Asdrubal, he has to play in that awful stadium 81 times. And then I thought, oh, man, he's going to have to play on turf, which is going to reduce his range even further.
Right.
Because the ball is going to be moving that much faster. And then I thought, well, don't they have Yunel Escobar? Is he going to play second? And then these considerations were confirmed by the articles I read of just like, well, we don't really know what's going to happen. When I saw it, those are my thoughts. I thought, well, obviously the whole talk about the qualifying offer was legitimate because they would have been dumb to have given him one if they were in the position to do so.
Right.
And two, my first thought was, poor Asdrubal, he has to play in that dome. And then I've had lots of images of him diving at balls and landing on that hard turf and just how angry he'll be down there. Just kind of sad, I guess. But I had this, it wasn't a thought, it was an article, although I can't give the appropriate person credit, but it was an article that chronicled the history of the Indians' shortstops for like the last 20 years. And actually, it was pretty interesting because, you know, shortstop is an important position. And over, like, the last, 20 years, say, is even longer than that, they've only had four. Because they had Vizquel
right,
forever.
Right, Vizquel was there forever.
Then they had Peralta forever. And then Cabrera. And now, you know, Jose Ramirez.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was actually kind of interesting to look at how they've managed to keep a fairly dependable person at a pretty important position. And they've set themselves up to continue it, obviously, with Lindor, you know,
right.
To go from Vizquel, Peralta, Cabrera to Lindor.
Yeah.
Huh. And, you know, Peralta, he's an interesting guy. It's like, I don't know if he's as bad as I always thought he was.
Yeah, I mean, he was not a good defensive shortstop, but...
But yeah, you know what it is?
A lot of offensive value.
He had a lot of offensive value, and that's where I think Indians fans got disillusioned with him. Because it was either his second or third year, he set the Indians club record for home runs by a shortstop. And everybody's like, oh man, you know, like I remember he was hitting fourth, like Hafner got hurt, and they put Peralta fourth, and I was like, oh, this is crazy. And then he's just clubbing home runs like mad, and you're like, wow, this guy's really good. And then he never hit like that again. And so I think that was part of the disappointment.
Yeah.
But I think what you didn't realize until you had to watch, because see, the same thing kind of happened. Like when Johnny Peralta came up, he was kind of a big shortstop, but he wasn't filled out. And as he got older, he filled out more, and his range got worse. And then the same thing happened to Cabrera. Like, when you switch from Peralta to a young Cabrera, you're like, oh, wow, this guy's so much better. And then Cabrera gets older, and you're like, oh, no, he's not. But when I think of Johnny Peralta compared to Ezdrubal Cabrera, the thing about Johnny was he didn't have good range, but the balls that he could get to, he always made those plays.
Yeah. Like,
always. Ezdrubal Cabrera would drive you bonkers. It's like, oh, he'd make some diving play behind second base and throw the guy out from his knees. And then the ball comes right to him, and it's like circus music is playing in the background. Like, that's what drove me, and I think a lot of people crazy about Cabrera, is he would do these, you know, web gems that would show up on SportsCenter or whatever. But you're like, yeah, well, you missed the one earlier in the third inning when he booted the ball and the runner was on third base and a run scored.
Yeah.
You know, that's what drove me crazy about Cabrera. And I think, when you look back, it was one of those things, like, you're almost like, I don't know, maybe I preferred Peralta because at least he was consistent. Like, when you listen to the radio, you know, and you hear Tom Hamilton say, Peralta gloves it, you're like, okay, he got him.
Right.
You didn't need to hear the rest of it. But when it was Cabrera gloves it, you're like, oh, God. Finish the play. But that's all I got to say about that.
All right. So anything else you want to hit on with the Tribe, or is that it for today?
No, I think that's it.
We covered it all, huh?
There's not much going on.
You know what, though? That was a long podcast today. I was thinking in my head, I was like, this will be like a 40-minute one. We got an hour out of that today.
We never go 40 minutes.
We don't ever, really, yeah. We usually do turn it into an hour. But in my head, because today we were, like, proactive. Like, before the podcast today, we talked about, like, yeah, it's going to be a quick one today.
Yeah.
No? It was
much
good.
To my wife's chagrin, we never go 40 minutes. I'm kidding.
She loves it. It's good. It's good. Everybody needs a hobby, Jason.
I have too many hobbies.
That's the problem. Too many hobbies. Well, that's going to be it for today. We'd like to again thank our listeners and ask if you're listening to us on iTunes that you give us a rate and review. You know, we'll be again recording sporadically throughout the offseason, so kind of keep your ears to the ground. But in the meantime, continue to check us out on the web at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter @tristatebb. And you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/tsmbaseball. So for Jason Ruggiero, this is Andy Berg, and we look forward to talking to you soon.